Case number 24-1193 et al. Chamber of Commerce of the United States of America et al. Petitioners versus Environmental Protection Agency and Liam Zeldin in his official capacity as Administrator, United States Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Lin for the petitioners, Mr. Walters for the respondents, Mr. Thomas Katz for the respondent.
Good morning.
Good morning. It may please the court. Albert Lin on behalf of petitioners. There are several independent errors that require vacature of EPA's rule designating PFOA and PFOS as hazardous substances under CERCLA. But I'd like to start with notice and comment, as we believe that is the most glaring error and would, standing alone, require vacature. Under this court's longstanding critical information precedent, it is a violation of the APA's notice and comment requirement when an agency introduces in the final rule new methodologies, conclusions, or data that does more than simply support prior disclosed data. EPA ran afoul of those precedents here when it introduced with its final rule a brand new totality of the circumstances analysis supported by a new 300-page regulatory impact analysis that at J387 to 389 weighed 29 different impact categories in comparing the advantages and disadvantages of the rule.
What's the study that you think EPA should have disclosed in the notice?
It's not a study per se. There's,
I mean, you're saying they didn't disclose the RIA. Like, yeah, sure. The RIA is the product of the rulemaking.
Of course.
The rulemaking will never come to an end if the end product has to be disclosed at the outset.
There are six different methodologies, assumptions, and quantitative analyses that they undertook. So I don't think it has to be a study per se. I think if you look at the owner-operator case from this court, it talks about a methodology that was used. It's not a specific study. So I could go through all six of them, but I'll just start with just a couple. I mean, the first is the EPA concluded that that it would entirely ignore costs at federal Superfund sites. And this, it said
but,
I think,
but they told you on the front end of the rulemaking, there is a unitary question, designate or no designate. It's an on-off switch. They proposed to do it, and they invited comments about whether costs should be considered, what costs should be considered. All of those questions they teed up, and they didn't. This is not a case where they have studies in their files that they're hiding. They quite reasonably expressed uncertainty, right? How in the world can you precisely quantify all this stuff? And they solicited input, and you all had every opportunity in the world to comment.
Your Honor, I think that's the difference between the logical outgrowth doctrine and the critical information doctrine. I think the Chamber of Commerce versus SEC case 2006 of this court makes that clear, where it says that, I mean, there was what this court called a bare request for comment on a potential change to the cost-benefit analysis. And the court said that that wasn't enough because the agency, that might be enough for logical outgrowth. Windows covering manufacturers case from 2023 distinguishes between the two. It says there was no logical outgrowth problem there, but there was a critical information problem. And here, yes, they asked for, you know, comment on, do we have to consider costs and tell us what costs you think we need to consider. But it then introduced whole assumptions and about how things that it was going to consider costs, conceptualizations of what is a cost and what is a benefit that were never disclosed. I think the federal, again, I have six different ones, but I'll start with the federal one. In the in the notice of proposed rulemaking and the economic assessment, where they talk about how there's a lot of uncertainty and they say, tell us something about costs, they highlighted the Department of Defense's estimates for federal costs and cleanups and said, hey, look at this. Here's something that, you know, might be relevant in the cost analysis, although they said we're precluded from considering costs. And then they turned around in the final rule and said, we're not going to consider federal costs at all. We're going to completely ignore what happens at federal sites, and we're only going to look at things that happen at non-federal sites. That is a, call it a methodology or call it an assumption or call it a conceptualization, but it is an underlying principle.
I get that. And you have some precedent on your side, no question about it. Owners and operators is a good case for you. Struggling. I mean, if we apply this doctrine as broadly as you're asking us to, I mean, we'll really get a big Vermont Yankee problem, and there's a big problem that we're effectively requiring formal rulemaking as opposed to informal rulemaking. If you have to put everything into the record, that's formal rule, into a record, that's formal rulemaking.
A couple answers to that, Your Honor. I mean, I think there's a question that you raise as to how the doctrine intersects with Vermont Yankee. And I think Judge Kavanaugh, of course, when he was
Professor
on
this, Scalia and Judge Kavanaugh thought it can't be reconciled.
Had a problem with that. But
we have to try to reconcile, but that sure this, counsels in favor of not being too extravagant in how we apply it.
I think it may counsel in favor of not expanding it, but I don't think we're asking for an expansion here. And I think if you, again, if you look at, and as you point out, I think there is a fair amount of precedent that really we fall within the heartland of it. Windows covering, American Public Gas, owner operator, Chamber of Commerce. All of these cases were talking about cost-benefit analyses, and there was some notice and comment request. But what was missing was either studies or methodologies. In one case, it says they didn't disclose the way in which they were going to apply this analysis. And here, and I mentioned the federal ones, but there's other, another one is this concept. Oh. Yes, Your Honor.
I just have a quick question. So I read those cases, they involved lack of notice on information that ended up changing in part or in whole the outcome of the rule. They were sort of had outcome impacts, the information that was left out. Do you have one where there what was not disclosed in the NPRM did not affect the outcome in part or in whole?
My answer to you would be to quarrel with the premise, because I think that these cases, there is a distinction between supplemental information and critical information, but I think a case like owner-operator, I don't think it changed what was in the final rule. It did not change the ultimate bottom line that had been proposed.
A significant relevant portion of it. I mean, it had what was added in had discernible impact. Something shifted from the NPRM to the final rule in something regulatory shifted in regulatory, something of regulatory consequence.
That's not how I read those cases. I think, for example, the Chamber of Commerce case, this court had reversed the previous rule for a mistake, what it found to be an error in the cost-benefit analysis, and that was
immaterial.
Correct. It was a material error, and then it was corrected. So I guess, Your Honor,
material about it.
I think it supported the cost-benefit analysis. The ultimate conclusion in that case, this court said that there was a mistake there.
But you have here, I guess, maybe I'm not being clear. What you have here is them in the NPRM and their economic assessment. First of all, dealing directly with direct effects, and they do that again in the final rule, and you're not challenging it. the notice requirements, okay? And then all that's going on here is about indirect effects. And in the indirect effects, they did their own sort of qualitative but not quantitative assessment, evaluation, analysis, and the economic assessment, and talked about the uncertainties, acknowledged the uncertainties, grappled with them, and said, here's where it comes out for us. Then you come to the final rule here. They do the same qualitative analysis. And then they get the quantitative one.
I understand. Nothing
of what I see you guys being concerned about, changed anything. These are all indirect effects and didn't change it. And in particular, there's just continued acknowledgement and not dispute by you of the massive amounts of uncertainty that you're even trying to predict here. And so I think I understand
the question. If I could answer, I think there's three different potential answers to that. The first is, even at a very, very high level, a 30,000 foot level, I think there was a fundamental change to the cost benefit analysis, because in the notice and the economic assessment, there wasn't a conclusion about whether costs outweighed benefits or benefits outweighed costs. They said in the
note, a qualitative one, but not a quantitative.
Not even on the qualitative. I don't think they reached a conclusion as to what one outweighed the other.
He said advantages outweigh disadvantages.
And then the second point is that on the qualitative stuff, Your Honor, there are different qualitative points that were raised here. If you compare, even in the economic assessment, they do talk about a few qualitative things, but they're limited, and actually went through and tried to kind of sort out what they were. And I think you can...
An owner-operator changed what the number of safe driving hours was.
And I'll get into the quantitative in a minute. But on the qualitative point, this is at JA 144 to 146. There's three pages of the economic assessment, and they mentioned four things: more efficient cleanup, earlier response activity, potentially increased research and development, and health benefits. Those are the four qualitative advantages and disadvantages that they say they can't quantify at the economic assessment stage. That's it. They also talk about a fifth thing, which is the transfer of cleanup costs from, quote, public to polluters. Okay, I will give them those five things: more efficient cleanup, earlier response activity, increased R&D, health benefits, and the transfer from public to polluters. But there are other qualities. What they introduced within the final rule is other qualitative conclusions. One of them, whether you want to call this qualitative or quantitative, is the exclusion of federal sites. But another qualitative conclusion is that they are going to treat all costs, new costs at non-Superfund sites, as benefits. Another qualitative...
Is that quantitative? I mean, Mr. Lynn, I guess my question is, do your notice and comment violation claims depend on the threshold question of whether costs have to be considered under 102? Because EPA is putting forth both qualitative and quantitative justifications. So if, for instance, their qualitative assessment was sufficient to support the designation, then would there be a notice and comment violation? I mean, your notice and comment violation, you know, critical materials arguments are all based on the fact that they have to consider economic costs and then they didn't provide the RIA and the relevant information for parties to comment on. So if the qualitative is sufficient, then is there no notice and comment violation? I mean, don't you have to win on the threshold question, too, that costs have to be considered?
So I think you're asking two different questions, but yes, costs have to be considered. I think it's a separate question whether what do you do with the qualitative versus quantitative. But yes, costs have to be
considered. Is it separate? Because if costs don't have to be considered, then you have to make an additional argument about why the qualitative considerations that EPA put forth. don't meet notice and comment. And you don't, I don't hear you making that argument.
I think that is premised on the idea that costs are only quantitative. I mean, when I say cost benefit, I'm happy to adopt their terminology of advantages versus disadvantages. I don't think that cost benefit is necessarily a quantitative analysis. I think it can, I mean, I think what Michigan requires is that you look at advantages and disadvantages, and costs are included in that. And that's part of the overall weighing. So that's why I think they're two different questions. I think the one question is, does the statute require them to do this sort of advantage versus disadvantage, weighing what goes into that? And then the second question is, did they provide sufficient notice of what they ultimately relied on?
But your notice arguments are largely based on failure to provide economic analysis, you know, like actual costs, not just advantages and disadvantages, right? That they didn't provide the RIA, that they didn't give any of this economic information.
And I think the answer to that, Your Honor, is that, I mean, I think what you do with the critical materials doctrine is you have to ask what EPA itself considered to be critical, which I think gets kind of all back to the third answer to Judge Millett's question about qualitative versus quantitative and did it make a difference. The government has argued in their brief that all of this quantitative stuff was just frills on it, right? It was just extra. It was illustrative. They didn't rely on it. But with respect to my friend, I think that's, if you look at the preamble, I think that's a post hoc litigation position of counsel. If you read just starting at JA-26, when EPA talks about the totality of the circumstances test that they have newly created in the final rule, they say EPA weighed the quantitative and qualitative costs and benefits evaluated in the RIA. EPA considered the estimated direct and indirect monetized costs. EPA also considered qualitative costs. And over and over, it talks about how it took into account the quantitative estimates of costs. And as a point of comparison, so they cite some stuff about, well, they say, well, we specifically said in the rule that we would reach the same conclusion without the quantification. The only place that appears is with respect to the consideration of quantified benefits. And that's at JA-32. EPA believes that the advantages of this action outweigh the disadvantages, even without consideration of quantified benefits. It never says that about quantified costs. And I think that comparison is important. You have to take the agency at its own word. It specifically says, and as it is allowed to do, we've done this analysis. We've tried to quantify the benefits and the costs. We think the benefits are sort of really hard to pin down, you know? So even without it, we think the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. They never say that for the quantification of costs. Instead, what they say is that they say things like future response costs are difficult to quantify. Unlike with benefits, though, EPA concluded that it has sufficient information to reasonably estimate anticipated future costs for NPL and non-NPL sites. So I think what this all kind of comes back to is, while the government has suggested that the quantitative costs here are just icing on the cake, what it really is when you read the preamble is it was butter, it was sugar, it was a critical ingredient to the totality of the circumstances.
Can I follow up on Judge Rouse's question? So suppose I agree with you that Michigan versus EPA does require consideration of cost, but I don't think either the statute or Michigan versus EPA requires a quantification cost. You with me on that?
I'm with you.
Okay, so as a conceptual matter, we'll get back to how EPA treated the two documents, but they could have done a qualitative assessment in the preamble for purposes of judicial review under the APA. And they could have done hundreds of pages of quantification in the RIA for purposes of an executive order that's not judicially enforceable. And our review would be just on the qualitative in that scenario, right?
With a caveat, but yes, I take it you're going further.
So quantification as a substantive matter is icing on the cake. They don't need to do any of it in order to have a non-arbitrary explanation consistent with Michigan versus EPA.
So I think the issue here, I'm trying to sort this out because I think the way to answer that question is this. Michigan leaves it to the agencies to, I think it says, to how best to account for costs. Mm-hmm. I think we think I would quarrel with the premise of your question, which is I think in order to do a reasonable advantages versus disadvantages assessment here, you have to take into account some of the quantification because these cleanup costs are massive. But accepting your hypothetical, I don't think it matters for purposes of the notice and comment question here, because what the critical materials doctrine and the critical information doctrine is asking is, did EPA give notice of what was critical to its analysis and its conclusion, which is why, with your indulgence, I was reading to you those parts of the preamble. I think what's really important here is when EPA concluded in the totality of the circumstances test in the final rule that the advantages outweigh the disadvantages, what motivated and underlay that ultimate decision? Because if the quantification there was important, and we think it's clear from the final rule that it was.
You do have these cross-references in the preamble to the RIA, which tends to support the argument you're making, which is we have to judge their explanation on its own terms. But boy, if we conclude that the qualitative analysis in the preamble would suffice for APA purposes. And like, it's really not that complicated. This is really dangerous stuff. The statute is focused on the designation part of the statute is focused on whether the chemical is hazardous to human health. And all of the downstream stuff about who pays what, like CERCLA has guardrails. So we'll worry about that later. Like, that's their basic rationale. And I mean, by APA standards, it hangs together pretty well. So, we're going to set this thing aside because of some fantastical possibility that buried deep in the RIA are some numbers that might change when they redo the calculations that they never had to do in the first place.
Well, Your Honor, again, I would fundamentally disagree with your reading of the preamble. I think if it were indeed, if all of these these numbers were fantastical icing on the cake, we will be dealing with a very, very different case. But they talk at length in the preamble about the shift in costs, the $50 million per year, the $18 million per year of costs at these sites that are going to be a meaningful advantage and a benefit of the rule. I mean, if I could, at JA 41, this is one that
just really in the preamble now.
This is in the preamble.
Yeah. Okay.
JA 41. This is in the context of discussing enforcement at non-Superfund sites. So this is all cleanup that nobody believes would exist but for designation, because this kind of enforcement against private parties can only happen if you have a designated hazardous substance. Quote, EPA acknowledges that costs parties expend to clean up PFOA and PFOS is a burden on them. But notwithstanding this, EPA views the cleanup monies, I'm sorry, I have a typo, it says movies. The EPA visits the cleanup monies spent by PRPs as an advantage of the rule. And if you look at that right there, they're talking about $18 million a year of cleanup costs that would not exist. But so there's a bunch of costs that they say would exist, even in the non-designation baseline. But these $18 million a year are costs that everybody agrees would not exist without designation. And they are treating these as benefits. And they say that these are an advantage of the rule. And these are the costs that they say they had sufficient information to reasonably estimate that they took into account as compared to the quantification of benefits, which they specifically say we'd reach the same conclusion even without them, as compared to litigation costs, where they say there's just not enough information for us to quantify that, so we're not going to. Okay, I'll accept that for purposes of this argument, Your Honor. They made a decision that they didn't want to quantify that. But I don't think there is any fair way to read this preamble in the way that the government has attempted to characterize it in their briefs, which is that—
Well, these private enforcements that you're concerned about, they do have to be conducted consistent with the National Contingency Plan. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the National Contingency Plan requires, at least when implemented by EPA, specific, site-specific balancing of costs, cost-effectiveness, consideration. Then you don't have all of these remote contingencies. Then it's not much more concrete, and you have to do a cost and cost balancing and a cost effectiveness analysis, right?
At that point, yes, Your Honor. Okay.
And so to be consistent with that, do private entities have to undertake that same, again, now it's more focused, cost effectiveness and cost pro-con, advantages, disadvantages, I forget what we're calling it now, balancing before it can happen.
I do think, yeah, yes.
And so you can understand how EPA up front is saying, we can't predict with much certainty at all at this point, other than maybe reference historical practice. But which states, which private entities are going to take up these cleanups on their own and then try to obtain compensation? Where, when, who, how much? And even if they want to do that, they're going to have to show that in undertaking that cleanup and incurring these costs, it was consistent. They did this inappropriate, or at least consistent with, it has to be identical. I'm not sure how consistent it has to be, but I don't know what that word consistent means, but it's going to have to consider costs and cost effectiveness at that point. And so why was it wrong for EPA to say, we want numbers, all right, we think it's past practice, maybe this is what's going to result, but who and when and where and whether any of it will actually shake out, because a lot of this stuff is already getting cleaned up anyhow as part of other cleanups. It seems to me you're wanting a lot more. In picking out those numbers, you're not sort of grappling with all the layers of uncertainty and all the layers of protection that actually even still exist for these private and state actions that are going to let you have that very careful analysis that you say you need to has to happen. You don't say this can't happen and this can't be listed. You simply say we need to get this beforehand, and you're going to get it beforehand, or you'll have an argument. If someone doesn't give it to you, then you'll have a good way to challenge it.
Your Honor, I think there's a couple different arguments in there. I think we do take issue with the claims of uncertainty and that there are some things that they say can't be quantified and they don't quantify. But I don't think you have to reach that to address the notice and comment issue, which goes to the quantifications in part that they actually did, right? So, Your Honor, some of these questions that you're raising about, you know, they say that they can't calculate.
It's only prejudicial if, in fact, they're wrong that the totality of circumstances analysis, or that their decision that we don't need to do this, and or our qualitative analysis was sufficient.
On notice and
prejudice by any of these numbers.
On notice and comment, the question of prejudice, this court has said, is not a high bar. The question is, did we have anything useful to say?
You have to win on the argument that they had to do a quantified, a dollars cost-benefit analysis. Because if the statutory answer is they give us sort of three options on the table, we don't have to do it at all at this hazard designation stage. The cost-benefit analysis you want is going to come later, much more site-specific in focus. That's one. Two, to the extent we have to do it, qualitative beyond the direct effect. So for the indirect effects, qualitative is permitted, and we've done that. Or three, it has to be number crunching. And you have to prevail on it has to be three. It has to be number crunching for us to say, well, when they predicted a range of expenses for private and state actions, they had to get that better?
I don't think so. I think the way I would suggest you think about the analysis is this. One, do they have to do an advantages and disadvantages weighing at all? I think the next question is, what did they do? But the first question is, do they have to do an advantages and disadvantages weighing at all? And I think the answer to that is
number one, so you have to win on
yes.
That.
And I think the answer to that is yes for a number of different reasons.
No, I understand your argument. I'm just saying you have to win on that before you're even prejudiced by any of this.
Yeah, and we'll so then we'll move on to that because I
your arguments
but
on
so the first is that. And I think the answer to that is yes for a number of reasons, one of which is the government has conceded for purposes of this case that they had to consider costs. In the preamble, they said kind of both things, but they've come into court, page 39 of their brief, and
qualitative
said,
or quantitative.
They have to do some sort of weighing. Appropriate means you've got to look at the relevant factors and weigh advantages versus disadvantages. I think the answer to that is yes, whether it's on a party presentation ground or if you look at Michigan directly. I think Michigan, the way the statute set up applies to that. We can talk about that, but that's question one. I think as to two and three, Judge Millett, and this gets back to my dialogue with Judge Katsas, I think they sort of collapse into, and what did EPA think was critical to its analysis, right? Because if EPA says we had to do an advantages to disadvantages, the next question for purposes of notice and comment is, what did they do and what was critical to their conclusion? And that is the sort of colloquy that we had, which is, I think the preamble makes very clear that the numbers that they did crunch, at least with respect to costs, they absolutely relied on them because some of those costs, $18 million and $51 million, they considered benefits. And I think that is the question. I don't think we have to win on, do they have to consider quantitative because they did?
I don't think they said we considered this particular dollar amount the benefit. I think they said we, as the statute is designed, consider the transfer of these costs, which is going to happen at some point. It's to some degree to be a benefit because the statute considers that a benefit.
Well, right. And that gets.
I don't read their decision that if it's not 18 million, then we would decide this. Then we're going home. We're not regulating this.
So, one, I think they do. But two.
You think they say that if the benefits are not this dollar amount, the dollar amounts we've identified or that range, then we would not regulate this.
I spoke too quickly. I'm sorry. There is no sentence that says that specific thing.
Do you even think that's.
I think it's part of it because they call it a totality of the circumstances test. They don't identify which 10 things are on this side of the ledger and how you weigh them against the other 10 things. What they do have at, and again, I'm sorry, I've lost it now, JA, I think it was 387, they have a table in the RIA that they refer to a cross-reference from the final rule that has the 29 different impact categories that are the costs and benefits that were taken into account in the totality of the circumstances. And they don't tell us exactly how you weigh one thing or the other. They do at one point say the quantification of the benefits we can sort of take or leave.
So Mr. Lynn, let me ask another question. Is your notice and comment argument contingent on the fact that the reasoning is arbitrary and capricious?
I think it's contingent.
Because many of these arguments that you're making now are not about, you know, critical materials and notice per se, but just that internally the rule is unreasonable or poorly reasoned or
I think you can't
sort of trace the reasoning.
I think it's both because I think we.
And are they separate or are they connected?
They are connected in part. So the notice and comment analysis, I think we have to identify some things of which we were not given notice that were critical. And then we have to establish prejudice. I think the prejudice argument knocks up against the argument that the reasoning is arbitrary and capricious. But under this court's cases, we don't have to actually win the arbitrary and capricious argument on those things of which we weren't given notice, right? We just have to show that we had something useful to say that would create some uncertainty as to the outcome. But the court has said, we don't have to show that it would have convinced the agency to go the other way on those pieces of it. But one other thing I did want to stress is...
At some level, it cannot be that when you have, you know, you point out how long and comprehensive and multi-factor this weighing of advantages and disadvantages was, both qualitative and quantitative. And all you got to do is find one number and say, oh, we would have told you a different number. And then we always send it back. It's
not
a never-ending cycle.
Not always, but the problem here is with the way EPA did its analysis. You can just, as a hypothetical, if they had actually done, and it is not, I'm saying that they had to do this, right? But if we had a different case where they said there are $100,000 worth of benefits over here, and there are $50,000 worth of costs over here, and then there's, you know, there's some other qualitative benefits that go above and beyond that. And if we found a problem with you would know better which pieces of those, how they fit together in the analysis. But EPA here has chosen to do what they call a totality of the circumstances test. So they haven't built the Jenga tower for us to understand what each individual piece does. And I think what we've identified
are... Your burden to show prejudice.
Yes.
And agencies do totality of circumstances analyses, not uncommonly, and they're allowed to do that. Michigan versus EPA calls for that. And so I don't understand what that means. If you say they have to give you sort of some sort of analytical framework, sort of a whole program here that says, and by the way, if this one changes, whoa, that's bad. If this one changes, it doesn't matter so much. I mean, I think the burden's on you, and I'm having trouble understanding, especially when you're mixing qualitative and quantitative in the balancing, how simply your objections, which seem to be really very data specific, this number versus that number. Well, we would have told you this number versus that number, not the mode of analysis, not what they've done. It's you didn't consider this, or you failed to add that one in. You have to show that it was going to make a difference, don't you? Big enough to make a difference.
No, I don't. Not in this, as a general matter, the prejudice standard does not require us to show that we would have convinced the agency to come out in a different way. All it requires is for us to show that we had something useful to say.
We're going in circles here. It has to be, it can't, because I thought you agreed, it cannot be, wait, we had 50 cents more to add, right? You could have added that. I think you would say that's not useful and that it's not going to be material to an analysis. And so don't you have to show, it's not just that we have a different number. Courts are rarely ever going to say which of the two numbers for an agency in a technical area like this is right. So it has to be more than just we had a number. We had a number that could, you don't have to show would for a notice, but that could have changed this.
And I think we have done that for two reasons. One is that these aren't just numeric complaints. And Your Honor, I think I was unable to circle back around to your question before about the 18 million. If the 18 million were different, would they have sort of taken the ball and gone home, right? The complaint about the 18 million, and this gets to Judge Rao's question before about is it quantitative or qualitative? I think there is a qualitative element to our complaint about that. And then there's another thing, which I haven't mentioned yet. But on the 18 million, it's how they're treating that 18 million. Whatever magnitude that number ends up being, the point is that they have decided, the EPA has decided, that 18 million of new costs will be treated solely as benefits. That is a big conceptual swing, no matter what that number is. Things that should be in the cost column.
Why? Why can't they just make a first cut global assessment that these chemicals are dangerous enough that, like, they should be cleaned up. And then all of the particulars about, you know, what if it's just one part per trillion and it's not worth doing, it just gets handled post-designation.
So, Your Honor, I think you're, just to make sure I understand, you're asking a sort of the threshold question about...
They can just make a general assessment. The only question before us is, could they permissibly designate these chemicals as hazardous? And they look at the science, and you haven't contested any of this. They conclude these chemicals are really dangerous because birth defects and cancer and everything else. And the conclusion is, as a general matter, right, arbitrary and capricious, we're not fly-specking too much. They say there should be cleanup. And that's true regardless of whether the site is on the national priorities list or who's going to do the initial cleanup, who's going to get hit as a potentially responsible party. Just seems like that's a categorically rational decision on the threshold question whether to designate or not. And then you have all these details on the back end about, you know, which sites do you do first and how much do you have to clean up and do you not bother if the concentration is really, really small?
A couple of answers to that. I mean, again, I think the first answer to that, Your Honor, is that's not what they did. They have said they did.
I'm suggesting that might be what they're doing when they say this is really a benefit. This is a net benefit. Cleaning the stuff up in non-NPL sites is a benefit, no?
And but it's part of the way that they weighed advantages and disadvantages. And it's a totally new method or assumption about how you think about whether those costs are advantages or disadvantages that they didn't give us notice of. And we could have had this very debate with the agency if they had actually provided notice and comment. I think that's ultimately the notice and comment complaint, is that there are whole pieces of how they thought about the advantages and disadvantages. Some of them are numbers, others of them are not. Another example.
So, Mr. Lynn, would you have the same argument if the preamble said perhaps more clearly something like what Judge Katz has said, that we are making a qualitative judgment that these are hazardous substances that need to be regulated, and we have an economic justification separately? Would you have the same argument about
that? I think it would be a different case.
It would be a different case.
It would be a different case on the notice and comment, although we would, I think, on the qualitative judgment, we'd have to see what went into their qualitative judgment. If it was Judge Katz's, like, kind of a one-liner about, well, we've sort of generally weighed the qualitative.
Well, that was partly why I asked the question towards the beginning of this argument, which is, do you have to prevail on the threshold question about whether costs are part of 102? Is it, because if it's sufficient to simply do a kind of, you know, qualitative assessment about what's a hazardous substance, then can you still prevail on your arguments?
I think we can, because on the notice and comment,
because of what they did, but not necessarily because of the law.
Well, but those two things go together, right? Because
sorry, finish.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Because if the law requires that they do an advantages and a disadvantages assessment, which, again, was sort of step one to the analysis, and they do it and they reach that conclusion based on a number of, whether it's data or methodologies or assessments that they don't give us any notice of and any opportunity to comment on, and that is the basis for their advantage and disadvantage assessment, then there is a notice and comment violation. And the question is whether that was prejudicial, right? That's the next question.
102 is just a purely precautionary provision. And EPA can decide that something is a hazardous substance because it affects the environment or human health. Then do you have a winning argument?
If they don't have to do the advantages and disadvantages.
Well, advantages and disadvantages are so broad, but...
If they don't have to do anything other than consider whether the substance is hazardous.
Yes.
Then the notice and comment argument does fall away because that is premised on the idea that the word appropriate in the statute requires them to do an assessment of these
some kind of assessment.
Some kind of assessment. Again, as we've talked about, I think the government has conceded for purposes of this case that that is what they, that Michigan does require them to do that.
They conceded, they just assumed without deciding that they win anyhow. That's different than a concession.
I think what they have, maybe the way that I would put the concession is they have said to this court that it should be assumed in this case.
Yes, EPA assumed without conceding at the final rule stage of Section 9602 was not.
And therefore, the only live issue in this case is whether the costs.
I'm just clarifying.
Yes.
That's important.
I think as if you read on in that paragraph, it says that, and therefore, the only live issue here is whether the cost-benefit analysis or the advantages and disadvantages weighing was done correctly. And so I think they're asking this court to assume that they were required to do that. And the question is whether they did it correctly. And whether they did it correctly, one question is whether it's arbitrary and capricious, but a threshold question is whether they provided sufficient notice and comment. Some of them are numbers, and some of them
are... They provided this $18 million number in the NPRM. They give you, said, this is what we think this advantage is. Where have you shown what you would have done differently other than substantive debate whether it's the statute allows them to consider that an advantage?
What we've said about... Oh, I'm sorry. I missed the last part of your question.
So we didn't have the notice. I mean, one of the ways we think about prejudice is, well, if you usually people say, well, had yes. they told me yes. this, then we would have done, had they told me X, we would have done Y.
So there are two objections that we have mm-hmm. to the $18 million
number. Omission from the NPRM.
One of them is that they considered that $18 million, again, could have been bigger, could have been smaller, that they considered it as a benefit and not as a cost.
That's more a legal argument than a notice argument, isn't it?
I think it is still a notice argument because it deals with how they ended up. This gets to the quantitative versus qualitative. I think it's qualitative in the sense that they decided they're going to consider that whole category of stuff.
You've made all these arguments, right?
We did not make that argument in the comments because they didn't preview that they were going to take these new costs and treat them conceptually as benefits. And the other thing, so that's one objection, and that's a qualitative objection. As to the actual $18 million number, that only counts federal enforcement. And they say that they're not going to calculate in that $18 million what happens with private and state enforcement at those non-Superfund sites. And one of the things we point out in our brief is that historical data shows that only a third of enforcement at those sites is by the federal government. And so, again, if we had had an opportunity to comment on it, we would have explained that that is a woeful undercounting of the costs that will occur at these new sites, because two-thirds of enforcement occur by somebody other than the federal government. So I think we did have, not to overuse the phrase, but, you know, useful comments about...
They would have just upped the benefit value.
Maybe. Who knows? And who knows how they would have done it? But that's the whole point of the notice and comment process. And the other qualitative problem that we have, which I haven't gotten to, is they count these operational changes to sort of cut down on the potential releases of this chemical as a benefit. It's included in the chart at 387 to 389 as a benefit. But then in the totality of the circumstances analysis, they tell us that they're not going to consider the costs of those actual changes. Again, I don't know if you want to call that quantitative or qualitative. There are no numbers attached to that, so let's call it qualitative. It's a qualitative conclusion to count only the benefit of operational changes to cut down on releases of PFOA and PFOS, but then they refuse to count what the changes would actually cost.
I thought what they said is it's complicated because it's no longer being manufactured in this country, correct? These two
that is correct.
Substances are no longer being manufactured. So you don't have those types of costs. And so then you simply have questions of, coming in, I guess, through imported products. So you have that complexity of them trying to predict. So it's not going to be the sort of linear analysis of you counted it here, you didn't count it there at all. I think they explained why they were doing what they were doing. And it also gets more complicated in this case because there are other statutes that keep kicking in and covering a lot of this stuff, whether it's hazardous waste or other. There's a whole network of statutes that are covering, and these are already, some of these costs are already getting covered under these other programs anyhow. And then the PFOA and PFAS are often, only getting cleaned up when, and this could be, I don't know why this would be any different for private and state enforcement rather than federal. It's at sites, if they're already cleaning up the sites, this is getting cleaned up as a part of that. There's not, so far as they said, they don't think that there's huge amounts, or they're unclear how much of it's going to be a pure PFOA or PFOS cleanup. So it's on top of things that are already getting cleaned up. So you have to be able to figure out how to back all of that out. And so it's, I think they've dealt with the uncertainties and the complexities and the, not only is it not linear, I mean, this thing is, an absolute jigsaw puzzle in trying to sort of even trace things. So they weren't playing the game that I think your analysis was suggesting. We're going to only count the good and not the bad. But they explained it, and I don't know what more we asked of them in this context.
Your Honor, what they say is that, here it is, J387, said they count under deferred benefits the requirement to report releases may lead to improved handling, storage, transportation, and waste management and treatment practices. And then they say in their brief that the costs of those practices are not fairly attributable to the rule.
Waste management's already regulated.
But why would you count those changes as a benefit when you don't count the costs of making those changes? That is what Business Roundtable—
Except there's any costs, it's a benefit, but a lot of it's already getting captured. I mean, you're the ones who have to show there's something material.
I don't, Your Honor, with respect, I don't think that's what the agency said. I don't think
that could have, if not would have.
I think
positive outcome.
I think that they say that they count these as deferred benefits, which is why this table is so helpful. And then they say that the cost side of that in their brief at 62 to 64 is not fairly attributable to the rule. That is an internal inconsistency in how you treat costs and benefits under Business Roundtable. I did have the statutory argument if this court is interested in discussing
it. I just have a quick question about your non-delegation argument. So my reading of your brief is that you were not challenging Section 102 as being an unconstitutional delegation.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, but then I'm not sure what your argument is. I'm not sure exactly what you're asking this court to do then, because, I mean, Justice Scalia is very clear in Whitman that agencies can't cure an unconstitutional delegation with a different interpretation. And you seem to be suggesting that the interpretation EPA has adopted raises constitutional concerns, which suggests that they could adopt, a different interpretation that would address those concerns. I'm not exactly sure what what even ideally you would like from this court with your non-delegation argument.
Your Honor, I think you're pretty close to it. So I think our argument is the statute is being read in a way that is allows them standardless and limitless discretion to designate substances, and that runs up against the non-delegation doctrine.
But the question is the statute... Does the statute lead to standardless, no intelligible principle decision making? And you're not arguing that the statute lacks an intelligible principle or violates the non-delegation principle.
So the next step to the answer is, so our argument is that their interpretation of the statute is incorrect. And what we are asking this court to say is that their interpretation of the statute as allowing for a possibility, but not a certainty of substantial danger, is so broad that it runs afoul of the non-delegation doctrine, that it's inconsistent with the statutory hierarchy, and that you should vacate the rule and send it, you know, and give them another chance if they would like, as they have indicated that they would in this press release that is cited in the briefs, to interpret the statute correctly and in
we
a way.
We would just say this interpretation is
incorrect.
Is incorrect, but we what would we say the correct interpretation is? I don't see
I don't think
in your brief.
I don't think this court has to interpret.
It was a little, I mean, if we under Loper Bright have to say what the law is, we just say, well, it's not what the EPA says, but that's it.
I think that that's right, Your Honor. I don't, with respect, I don't think Loper Bright tells you that you have to, in every case that raises a statutory question, and interpret the statute. I think what it says is the court exercises independent judgment, and it doesn't defer to the parties or the agency. And so the question is, did they get it right?
Wait, but usually when you say that the agency has gotten it wrong, courts have some account of what the right interpretation is.
We have suggested.
I don't see what that would be from the petitioners.
We have suggested in our reply brief that may should not be read as possible, but something more like able to. We have, when we talk about when you have may in the contingent clause with when released into the environment, blah, blah, blah. So there are other interpretations of the statute. We haven't asked this court to adopt that interpretation.
Do you have an interpretation that wouldn't cover these chemical substances?
It's hard to say whether the science would actually satisfy the interpretation that we've set forth.
Do you have an interpretation that you believe it would be unlawful for them to say meets this meets? Do you think you're able to wouldn't be met? Isn't met even on this record?
I think a few answers. One, I think this court can't actually uphold the rule on that ground because it would be a different statutory interpretation. But to answer your question directly, I can't say based on the science whether EPA would ultimately be able to reach that
their
conclusion.
Their findings don't show that this is able to cause these things.
What the findings show, and Judge Katsas, I was going to point this out earlier, you had suggested that they said that it causes all of these things. I think if you look at what the findings say, it says that they're associated with certain health effects. Right. And look, we acknowledge that under a correct reading of the statute, which I think would be more restrained than possible, there is still some discretion for the agency in figuring out whether the science meets that standard. And we just can't know how that's going to play out in practice until the agency operationalizes a correct and new reading of the statute.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Riley Walters for EPA and Administrator Zeldin. I'll start here on the top with the notice and comment argument. Interested parties were on notice that EPA may consider costs in the final rule. EPA solicited a comment on the cost question. And this was not just a bare request for comment, as my friend suggested. EPA solicited a comment on every aspect of the question. This is at JA 78.
Well, what does it mean to solicit comments on costs where the agency has top line position is costs don't matter?
Well,
and then, but yeah, please go ahead and give us some comments on costs. Like, how can those comments possibly address what the agency is considering when they've said that costs don't matter?
So, Your Honor,
because that's what it said in the proposed rule.
Two responses, Your Honor. So, EPA did provide an economic assessment that provided the basic framework for how it was thinking about the cost issue. And in the actual solicitation for comment itself, EPA said, do we have the statutory authority to consider costs, or are we required to consider costs under the statute? If so, what costs and what benefits should we consider? How should we weigh those costs and benefits? And how do those costs and benefits factor into the ultimate designation decision? And then EPA provides the economic assessment that lays out the general framework.
Well, that's more like a request for information than comments on what the agency is in fact doing or the justifications that they have for their proposed rule. The justification is we don't really need to think about costs. Here are some top line considerations of advantages and disadvantages. Please give us information about costs and benefits. Those things just don't match up.
You know, I think the agency did a little bit more than that in the economic assessment. So, for example, in the economic assessment, EPA, went through the general categories, direct costs. Those were the reporting costs. EPA provided a quantified figure there. EPA looked at direct benefits, such as better information on the scope of contamination and faster cleanups. That was noted as a benefit. It also looked at costs.
How does all that match up with the 300-page RIA?
Your Honor, I think the 300-page RIA is the logical outgrowth of that because, again, EPA was relying on the same general categories and simply expanded on that framework. And I think the best evidence that petitioners had a meaningful opportunity to comment on the cost question is the fact that they did comment on it. The chamber submitted a 20-page cost report with quantified numbers, and EPA considered that information along with information supplied by other interested parties and explained why it disagreed. And so the notion that petitioners were surprised by the cost analysis in the RIA, I think, is hard to square with the record and given their own comments.
Well, so they commented, but they didn't have notice, really, of what EPA was going to, of at least any kind of detailed information. I mean, the fact that the chamber could pull together comments about costs that they thought the agency might consider to be relevant, it's not, it shouldn't be on regulated entities to guess what kinds of costs and benefits an agency is going to take into account.
Your Honor, I don't think, and this record supports that they were guessing. Again, in the economic assessment, EPA provided extensive information of the types of costs and benefits it was considering, and most of these were qualitative, almost all of them were qualitative, and these are the same qualitative costs and benefits that were considered in the RIA. And this went out for comment. Petitioners had an opportunity to address, for example, if EPA was thinking about this wrong, if EPA needed to provide a more robust quantitative analysis, if a qualitative analysis would have been insufficient, they had the opportunity to do that. And I think under this court's logical outgrowth cases, that's more than sufficient.
How do you reconcile your position with cases we have like owner-operator, which seems to treat methodology as its own category and something that must be disclosed to some degree, must be disclosed at the outset?
So you're right.
And does it on an existing, incredibly hard look basis, like one aspect of the cost benefit calculation, one aspect of that methodology didn't get disclosed, and we reversed on that basis.
Yes, Your Honor. I think owner-operator is a critical materials doctrine case. What the right. court said there was that the particular methodology that did not go out for comment was
critical materials, which sort of suggests like the hiding a secret study point, but in fact was about an undisclosed methodology.
Right, it was about a methodology. Totally, we agree, Your Honor. And what the court said in owner-operator was that methodology was an integral part of the model that itself was the central justification for the rule. And so the court said that the public lacked the opportunity to comment on the most critical factual material in the case. We don't have anything like that here. Here, the general framework for how EPA was thinking about the costs did go out in the economic assessment. But my friend on the other side seems to focus most on here are the quantified illustrative estimates. And those were not a critical part of the cost analysis, and the cost analysis was not the central justification for the rule. So I don't think owner-operator is anywhere close to this case.
I would agree with you if you had written the preamble a little bit differently and said, this is the qualitative analysis that we want to stand on for APA purposes. Mm-hmm. And we've done this whole other number crunching thing for the EO. But there are these seeming cross references in the preamble where you did seem to take on the whole burden of that multiple hundred page thing. I mean, I don't know why you would do it, but you seem to do it.
So, Your Honor, I think the question of whether EPA considered those numbers is different from whether they were critical material in the case. So it's true, Your Honor, in the preamble, EPA did note that it considered the quantified figures, but it noted throughout the preamble and in the RIA itself that these were merely illustrative. It notes time and again, for example, at JA-26, that the RIA doesn't fully capture the costs and benefits because there's just too much uncertainty. JA-36 and 37. Which,
give me your best shot, best one or two sites in the preamble for the proposition that the agency would have done the same thing without the RIA.
So I direct you to JA-26, Your Honor. And again, EPA did not use that exact language. But it, again, it goes to EPA was expressing the fact that there is so much uncertainty associated with these quantified costs and benefits. And
I think where on 26? I have kind of the money quote is maybe a third of the way down on the left-hand column, which says the analysis included consideration of the RIA.
So the far right column, Your Honor, on JA-26, last paragraph where it says, first sentence, the RIA does not fully capture the quantitative cost or benefits of the rule due to data limitations. But
Mr. Walters, I mean, EPA also says that it is assuming that costs and benefits have to be considered.
Right.
But then it says it's only using the costs and benefits as illustrative. So how do you have it? Either it seems that EPA should rest on the fact that Section 102 allows it to make a purely qualitative or hazard-based determination. That's one justification. But on EPA's own reasoning, it says it's assuming that it needs to do this type of balancing, and then it points to the RIA and other economic justifications. So then doesn't that have to be reasonable on EPA's own terms?
Yes, Your Honor, it does need to be reasonable, but EPA, again, assumed that it had to consider costs and benefits. It did not assume that it needed to perform a quantitative analysis of costs and benefits. And the only figures that are described as illustrative are those quantified figures. We agree, for purposes of this analysis, EPA did need to consider qualitative costs and benefits. But under Michigan, the court went out of its way to say it was not requiring agencies to assign a monetary value to each cost and benefit. It recognized that a qualitative analysis may be appropriate in certain contexts, and we think this is a context where a qualitative analysis provides more information.
So then does EPA have to prevail on the threshold statutory question that Section 102 does not require consideration of costs?
So, no, Your Honor, we assume for purposes of this analysis that we did have to consider costs. Not quantitative costs. Again, because we're at the designation stage, this is a preliminary stage in the CERCLA cleanup process where there's just not enough information to provide robust quantitative analysis. And so we don't think the court needs to decide whether EPA is required to consider cost. However, if the court thought that EPA erred in its cost analysis and that was the issue in the case, then I think the court would have to decide the question of what the statute requires. But we don't think the court has to reach that in this case.
Because the qualitative assessment is sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the 300-page RIA is just illustrative, so it's not critical material.
No, we're not, I'll make it very clear, we are not arguing that the 300-page RIA is just illustrative. We're talking about the quantified figures, the four quantified estimates that EPA acknowledged were being made based on imperfect assumptions and a lot of uncertainty. EPA labeled those estimates as illustrative. The qualitative analysis was not illustrative. That was part of EPA's weighing of the advantages and disadvantages in the case. And Your Honor, Judge Katsas, going back to your question, for one more site I think that may be helpful here is in the RIA itself, it's JA-592. In here—
In the RIA.
It's in the RIA, yes, Your Honor. And there, EPA said that significant uncertainties prevent a robust quantitative analysis here. And so if the agency was treating these quantified figures as critical to the rule, I don't think the agency would admit that these are not robust figures. That would be an admission to arbitrary and capricious decision-making. One more point on whether these illustrative figures were critical to the rule. Michigan, the EPA, said the word appropriate requires consideration of all relevant factors, and cost is one of those factors. So, you know, agencies can't ignore cost when Michigan applies. But again, they're just one factor, the one quiver in the appropriate, or they're one arrow in the appropriate quiver. And EPA considered them as such. EPA also considered CERCLA's purpose and whether designation would further CERCLA's purpose. Also considered whether there were other authorities that the agency could use to address PFOA and PFAS, and it concluded that CERCLA was the best authority that was available. And so these illustrative estimates were just one minor aspect of the cost analysis, which itself was just one minor aspect of the totality of the circumstances analysis under Michigan. And then all of that was just one aspect of the designation decision, which turned primarily on the scientific finding of substantial danger. And so I just don't think the record supports the claim that these illustrative figures were critical to the rule. It would have been better if we had said that more explicitly, Your Honor. I'll concede that. But I think there's enough in the record to agree with our position on that question. So I think that...
I'm inclined to agree with you to the extent we think of this. The first two of their four or five arbitrary and capricious challenges, which seem to me the strongest, are... One is a quantification of a range of 10.3 million to 57.1, and the second is the range of 327,000 to 18.1 million. And if we just put blinders on, look at that chart and say, is there a significant enough likelihood that the bottom line would change if those numbers were adjusted? That seems unlikely. But what if we take a step back on the notice and comment and just look at the whole scheme, and nothing was disclosed about the methodology for calculating any of these costs and benefits? To borrow a phrase, these two problems, from their perspective, are just illustrative of this global problem that they had no idea how you're going to go about thinking about this problem and or making these calculations.
Sir, I'm sorry, just so I understand the question, is the question, would there be a notice and comment?
Yeah, the notice and comment problem is broader than just the specific arbitrary and capricious objections.
Understood, Your Honor. So I think to the extent petitioners are arguing they didn't have a chance to comment on the quantified figures, which I know you were addressing here, or the assumptions behind those figures, for example, the assumption that, you know, EPA would bring enforcement actions at 67 non-MPL sites. We think those assumptions are part of the quantified estimates, and so that's all the same bucket. And my understanding from petitioners' argument is there really is only two other buckets of issues they say did not have a chance to comment on. One was this allegation that EPA characterized certain costs as benefits, Your Honor, and I just don't think the record supports that. In fact, the page that my friend cited, JA 41, he even quoted language where EPA recognized that these new cleanups that are taking place because of enforcement actions are costs for PRPs. And EPA even said that these cleanup costs were a, quote, burden for PRPs, but EPA reached the conclusion that the benefits justify those burdens. And EPA did say that it considers this an advantage of designation. That's because it furthers the purpose of CERCLA for polluters to pay for the contamination they cause. I mean, criminal statutes, for example, when they're enforced, they impose costs on criminals. When someone is put behind bars, that's a real cost. But we wouldn't say that there's no advantage to enforcing criminal law. It also serves other purposes. And
there's sort of Orwellian quality about the way that you talk about costs and benefits. So what you're at some point talking about real costs and burdens, but then when you want to flip the switch, you start talking about advantages and disadvantages. I mean...
Well, Your Honor, I think
it's sort of through the looking glass quality about the way these costs and benefits are being talked about. Yes, it's a burden on private parties to do cleanup, but we're going to take that as a benefit of the rule. I mean, I don't know how that's being mischaracterized by the petitioners here.
Your Honor, we didn't say that that cost was a benefit of the rule. Again, EPA
said it's an advantage of the rule.
The advantage
or
is
something like that. Well, is that different from being a benefit?
So, Your Honor, I think EPA's use of the words advantage, disadvantage, in many places are just interchangeable with costs and benefits. But it also is broader because, again, under Michigan, the appropriate, as may be appropriate language requires us to consider all relevant factors. One of those things EPA considered here was CERCLA's purpose, making polluters pay. So when it's using advantage there, it's talking about there is an advantage here for in furthering the purpose of.
On that reasoning, anytime a regulation furthers the purpose of a statute, and let's hope that the government is only regulating when the regulation would further the purpose of a statute, that regulation will always be advantageous. I mean, that's the reasoning of the EPA. So anytime a regulation is doing something that's within the statute and within the purpose of the statute, it's all beneficial. It's all good for society because it's furthering the purposes of the statute. I mean, that has no connection to how we have thought about costs and benefits or advantages and disadvantages. If every regulation that furthers a statutory purpose is advantageous, then there are no limits whatsoever on the EPA's regulatory power.
Your Honor, I agree with you. If we had ignored the costs that these enforcement actions impose on PRPs and just said it's a benefit because it furthers CERCLA's purpose, that would have been error. But we did not do that here. In fact, the chart, the helpful chart in the RIA, JA 387, this is page 7 of the RIA, it lists all the costs and benefits. Labeled under indirect costs are costs related to enforcement actions, the $327,000 to $18.1 million. So EPA treated these as a cost in its cost analysis. So, again, Your Honor,
you treat it as a cost, but then you wave away the cost by saying it's an advantage.
Yeah.
So, I mean, isn't that the same thing as just treating it as a benefit?
No, Your Honor, because I respectfully disagree that EPA just waived away the cost. In the language that my friend cited, EPA acknowledged that it was a cost and acknowledged that it was a burden, and then it said the benefits justify that burden. And then it also said it was an advantage to further CERCLA's purpose. So I don't think the advantage language was canceling out or erasing the prior language where EPA is acknowledging that it's a cost. It's a complex analysis for sure. But again, I would go back to the criminal statute. You can both acknowledge that enforcing criminal law imposes costs on certain people, and then also acknowledge that there are advantages to enforcing criminal law. They serve the purposes of deterrence. They serve the purposes of incapacitation. And I think EPA was doing something similar here.
So is there any situation, though, where the advantages of furthering a statutory purpose would not be greater than the costs of something?
It's
the sort of generalized reasoning that CERCLA has these purposes, which of course it does. And, you know, these substances, no one is questioning that they are harmful. Mm-hmm. Okay. But there's still a question of how we weigh the harms of that against the costs that it imposes on private parties.
Right. Your Honor, totally agree. And the question in these cases is whether the agency engaged in reasoned decision making. And I think there's a lot of deference that's owed to the agency in weighing costs and benefits in a complex scenario like this. And so I think the question here is, did EPA acknowledge costs? Did it acknowledge benefits? And how did it weigh them? And I think EPA did that reasonably here, especially given the stage of the process we're at. And again, just to make it abundantly clear here, so there's no doubt, we agree that EPA could not just relabel costs as benefits and ignore important costs that are imposed on society.
Can they rename costs as advantages, statutory advantages to the public?
It cannot ignore the cost. If EPA was ignoring costs and just saying, oh, well, it's a good thing, and so we're just going to label it an advantage and not even recognize that it's a cost, I think that would be a problem.
So it's sufficient to recognize there are costs. But then whatever the costs are, a statutory advantage can overcome that.
Your Honor, EPA reached the bottom line conclusion that the advantages of designation outweigh the cost.
Well, decision has to be reasonable.
And it has to be reasonable. So did the agency
justify and explain?
Exactly, Your Honor.
So if you decided it would promote CERCLA to have every single microscopic piece of these substances removed from the United States, and it's going to cost billions of dollars to do that, but that would be consistent with CERCLA's purpose, but then?
that would be a situation where designation very well may not be appropriate. And I can think of other examples for if the only available cleanup technology for removing the substance would cause even more danger to public health or the environment, that may also be a reason not to move forward. Or if the only available cleanup technology imposed extraordinary costs on society, if it cost $1 trillion to clean up the substance, that might be a reason not to move forward. So there are plenty of examples where I think costs could make a difference here. Here, EPA acknowledged costs, it acknowledged benefits, it engaged in reasoned decision-making, and I think that supports the decision.
Right. Thank you very much, Council. We'll give you some more time. We won't give you more time, but never mind. Thank you very much, Council. We'll hear from the intervener.
May it please the court, I'm John Kelmes-Katz for the Environmental and Community Interveners. No party disputes the most critical fact in this case. PFOA and PFOS may present substantial danger when they are released to the environment. That is the standard for designating hazardous substances under CERCLA, and petitioners have not provided any basis for overturning the designation of these highly toxic, persistent, and pervasive carcinogens. Today, I'd like to begin with the notice arguments the court has been discussing, and then I'd like to briefly address petitioners' claim that EPA's interpretation of substantial danger lacks limits. So, Judge Katchis, you had asked for record support for EPA's position that the cost estimates were not critical to its ultimate decision, in addition to JA-26, which we agree supports that. The first page of the rule, this is JA-002, refers to the RIA as an additional discretionary analysis. And I think that is how it was treated here. All parties agree that notice is only required for materials or here assumptions that are critical to the agency's ultimate determination. The RIA and its quantitative cost calculations were not critical for three reasons. First, and I would actually like to put a pin in this one because I don't think the court needs to reach it, there is a justification provided in this rule that does not consider costs at all. And CERCLA does not require EPA to consider costs here. So that is a basis for rejecting the notice argument. However, even if the court were to find that Michigan applied and that some consideration of costs was warranted, the RIA and its quantitative calculations would still not be critical. Michigan is very clear that agencies have broad discretion in how they assess for costs. And here EPA did provide the economic assessment with its proposed rule, which quantified direct costs and qualitatively addressed indirect costs. That satisfied any requirements that may have been imposed by Michigan or by CERCLA. And I think it is particularly important here, given the preliminary stage that this case is reaching this court. This is a decision about whether to add two substances to a list of some 800 hazardous substances. Any decisions about how to remediate the substances, where to remediate the substances, the decisions that really drive the analysis of costs are going to occur much later on a site-specific basis. And that is where Congress required EPA to consider costs. So to the extent that any cost consideration was required, it was satisfied by the economic assessment that was provided. Moreover, if you look at the agency's totality of the circumstances analysis, and this is at pages JA-26 to 41 of the Joint Appendix, I think it becomes readily apparent that the specific cost estimates that petitioners are discussing and even these conceptual kind of approaches that they claim were first announced in the RIA, and we would take issue with some of that, but they were not critical for the agency's decision. That is a 16-page analysis, which on its whole is overwhelmingly qualitative. In fact, I think the only page that references the specific cost estimates that kind of petitioners are talking about is the one that they mentioned at argument. There is one reference to qualitative cost estimates. If you look at that in the context of the totality of the circumstances analysis that the agency conducted, which looks at the harms associated with these chemicals, which looks at the statutory purpose, there's really no reasonable reading of that analysis where the court would conclude that these specific figures were the fulcrum, that these were the critical aspect of the agency's decision.
Can I just take you back to JA2 for a second?
Certainly.
The agency says we made the statutory assessment of substantial danger.
Yes.
And then it said we did other things that were discretionary.
Correct.
But it folds into those other things, not just the RIA, but more broadly, the assessment of advantages and disadvantages.
Well, Your Honor, our...
That seems to tee up the Michigan versus EPA question.
So it...
Like, I mean, I'll put my cards on the table. I don't think they're required to quantify, but I do think they're required under Michigan, at least qualitatively, to consider costs and benefits. And this passage that you pointed me towards seems to treat all of that as discretionary.
To the extent that is Your Honor's position, then we would say they have assessed that with the proposed rule and with the economic assessment. So they...
In the RIA or without getting into the RIA?
Without getting into the RIA. I think the economic assessment was rational. When you look at... And if you may, I'm going to discuss the remediation process because I think it becomes very clear when you look at this why the sort of precision they were looking for can't be provided at this stage. The remediation process begins with a comprehensive analysis of the contaminants at site. What is driving the remedy? Then EPA at a given site considers the feasibility analysis, which are what are the different options for remediating the contamination and how much do they cost? That can range from monitor natural recovery, which costs very little, to digging everything up and disposing of it in a hazardous waste landfill. And then EPA applies 8 different factors from the NCP.
I think we're familiar with the process here.
My point is that when EPA lists a Superfund site, it has no idea how much the remediation of that site is going to cost. Here we are stages before that and making the decision on a nationwide level. So it was perfectly reasonable for EPA to quantify direct costs and to qualitatively assess indirect costs in this case, Your Honor.
Any questions? Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Helen, we'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think what I'd like to sort of hit is, I think there may be tough critical materials cases, but this really shouldn't be one of them. We're talking about something that started as a 20-page economic assessment that EPA said it was not only not looking at, but couldn't look at, and has turned into a 300-page RIA. And the agency's position here is that they can throw a 300-page document at the wall and say that there's some uncertainty. And
our agency is allowed in an NPRM to say this is what we think the statute requires, but we're interested in your views, and then change their mind?
Yes, Your Honor. They are. And that gets to the
notice problem if they didn't.
Not under the logical outgrowth doctrine, but what we're talking about here is the critical materials analysis. And the agency's position here is that because they did a totality of
the... They have to do a whole other notice and comment and say, oh, that was persuasive. Okay, so now notice and comment on this. That's what you want. There should have been another round of notice and comment.
On the methodologies behind the quantitative assessments and on some of these qualitative conclusions about treating costs.
I assume benefits. That EPA was just running into the CRA deadline at the end of the administration. This is perhaps why they did not do another.
I would not be in a position to speculate on that, Your Honor.
You've seen a lot of 3-round notice and comments or 2 double notice and comments like that.
There are supplemental notice and comments that are done. And
supplemental like this. I'm talking about this would have been a very comprehensive one like that, where they go, we think this is our view of the statute, but let us know your views otherwise. So on a legal question,
Your Honor, I
come back with an answer to that legal question and information. And then they go, okay, we now agree with your position on that legal question. And now here's a new notice and comment.
I have not seen a case like this one where they said they were not going to do, they were precluded from doing a cost benefit analysis and then did. A 300-page.
Not precluded from doing it, that the statute didn't require it. That's a different thing.
They said it was they were precluded from doing it. That was
but the statute doesn't require it here, but doesn't mean.
No, no, they said the statute.
People have, they said, but that's not going to influence artists. I mean, what the statute would preclude them from doing is, I think in their view, is if we thought it was going to be very expensive, but this thing was as hazardous as all get out, we can just declare it not hazardous.
It would preclude them from taking it into account.
So this was a supplement.
But I think the main issue here is their contention is that this material is not critical because they said, even though the preamble says that they considered the quantitative analysis, that they said that it was, that there was still some uncertainty that the RIA didn't take into account all of these things. And I think just the most important point on this is there are places in the RIA and in the totality of the circumstances where they specifically talk about quantitative benefits that they could take or leave in their analysis. And they did not do that with respect to all of the things that we are complaining about. And
this only matters, the procedural point only matters to the extent you would have had something useful to say.
Yes, Your Honor.
So would you have had anything useful to say other than with regard to the specific substantive arguments you've made on arbitrariness?
In terms of the cost-benefit analysis?
Yeah, whatever critiques of the methodology, you've made four or five on the back end now that you've seen the methodology, points where you say the agency acted arbitrarily. Right.
Yes.
I'll spot you for purposes of this question. I'll spot you that you don't need to win those arguments to establish prejudice.
Yes.
On your procedural point.
So, Your Honor, if your question is,
is there anything else?
Are there other prejudicial arguments that we didn't make that we left on the cutting room floor? I think there are others. Within the limits of the words, we set forth what we thought were the best ones. Okay. I think the cost, treating costs as benefits discussion that was had with Judge Rao is, I think, as illustrative or exemplary as you can get in terms of the need for notice and comment. You heard government counsel here today walk away from what we read the rule to do, which is to treat these enforcement costs as benefits. And he says, we categorically, I'm putting words in his mouth, he said categorically, but he says, we don't think that that is an appropriate thing to do. Well, that would have been a nice conversation to have in the notice and comment process. And maybe we can disagree about what the preamble says, although I think it's pretty clear in my own mind. It says, we view the cleanup monies, can I movies, but the cleanup monies as an advantage of the rule. I don't know how you can read it another way, but the point is we shouldn't be having this debate here a year later in court. And then the one final point I wanted to make was he did acknowledge that if it cost, Your Honor, maybe your hypothetical is it cost $2 trillion or something, or maybe he said $2 trillion. The other thing, there's been a lot of talk about the numbers. I think that's only part of it. But one thing I do want to clarify, the $18 million and the $51 million, the upper end of the ranges that we're talking about, those are annualized over 77 years. When you look at them in terms of present day cost, and it's in here, JA 535, the present value cost of the $18 million is $721 million. And the present day cost of the $51 million is $2 billion. $2 billion.
Present value of that cost stream discounted.
$2 billion with a B, to borrow from a former colleague of yours who was invoked Judge Kavanaugh. So I think it's important. We're not talking about chump. We're not talking about chump change here. But of course, the quantitative complaints are only part of our issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to all counsel. The case is submitted.